What's good, everyone? My name is Jacob Moses, community builder at Strongtowns, and welcome to It's the Little Things, a Strongtowns podcast where in each episode, we focus on a different action that you, the concerned citizen, the elected official, the city planner, can take to make your town stronger. This episode's action? Starting a neighborhood grocery co-op. Say you live in a neighborhood where residents have poor access to groceries, such as produce, meats, and other household necessities. You have the liquor stores and the fast food spots, but no establishment where you can purchase items to prepare a healthy meal. What solutions come to mind to solve this problem? Likely, only one. Do whatever you can to lure a grocery corporation to move to town. Sure, you may successfully incentivize a corporation, but it'll likely take subsidies and tax breaks, making your town less financially resilient. That's why in this episode, we're going to cover another solution. Starting a neighborhood grocery co-op that through democratizing the decision-making process, building local capital, and pooling the risk, gives your neighbors better access to groceries while making your town more financially resilient. To help us unpack this action, I've got Jacqueline Hanna, Assistant Director at the Food Co-op Initiative on the podcast, to share with you how you can start a neighborhood grocery co-op in your town, including how to pitch the vision to community members and elected officials, how to translate your enthusiasm into action, and how the Food Co-op Initiative can help you through every step of the process. Enjoy. Hey there, Jacqueline. How are you today?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How's life in Champaign, Urbana?
It's 69 degrees and sunny, so I cannot complain whatsoever.
That is a nice little day.
Yep.
Well, Jacqueline, so happy to have you on the podcast today. We have a great action to cover together, and that is starting a neighborhood grocery co-op.
Yeah, not a small undertaking. Thanks so much for having us here to talk about it.
Yes, we're overjoyed to hear your expertise. And Jacqueline, co-ops, we're a big fan of them over at Strongtowns for several reasons, but mostly because of their financial resiliency. You know, we're able to provide healthy foods in our neighborhoods without giving huge tax breaks or subsidies for a corporation to move into town. It's a business model that serves community members as opposed to investors solely focused on profit. It's a bottom-up approach to expanding the tax base. All great stuff that I know we're going to dive more into in this podcast. To get us started, Jacqueline, I'd love to start with the origin story of the Food Co-op Initiative. Flashback 11 years, what were y'all noticing in communities across the country that motivated you all to start this nonprofit?
Well, I actually was at the time the general manager of a food co-op. Food Co-op Initiative 11 years ago was started by a few others, including our executive director, Stuart Reed. And what was happening, interestingly, is you might remember there was a little bit of a economic downturn happening then. And people were starting to connect the idea of maybe things aren't working because we no longer have any economic control. Maybe these companies, these corporations don't have concern for our communities. That was becoming clearer to more folks. And so those of us who were running established food co-ops were starting to get these phone calls. And we were starting to get a lot of them. And the question was, how do we start a food co-op? And tough question, because if you're running an established food co-op that was started in the 1970s, and most of the ones thriving today were, although some were started more recently and some as far back as the 1940s, but we weren't there for those origin stories, and it was a very, very different time. What we did do then is not what would work now. And so we had a whole bunch of general managers all over the country running food co-ops who were like, wait a minute, are you getting these calls? are you getting these calls? And so it became clear, well, you know, we need to strike while the iron's hot. There's this new passion to start more food co-ops. And we only know so much. There's only been so many food co-ops that were really opened the decade before that. Most of us had come out of the 70s and 80s. And so it was time to start collecting the knowledge from those who had more recently opened food co-ops and start building resources for these communities that wanted what we had.
Wow, that's remarkable, Jacqueline. So a lot of this started off just out of desperation. You know, like you said, there was an economic downturn in cities and towns across the country, and they needed healthy food. We didn't have any corporations moving in. So people took the initiative and took it upon Absolutely. Themselves to start to create these co-ops themselves. That's wonderful, Jacqueline. I want to talk a little bit about the diversity of all the places that the food co-op initiative supports. You know, your website says you have 144 new co-ops, over 100 in the works. Maybe listeners, they're only associating food co-ops with maybe rural towns or smaller towns. I imagine with 144 new co-ops and 100 in the works, that's not the case. Could you expand a little bit on the diversity of all the places where we see food co-ops Absolutely. And where they can thrive?
It's very, very diverse. Interestingly, usually when we talk about food co-ops in new communities, their assumption is college towns, quite like the one that I live in, that a lot of the food co-ops that came out of the 70s were started at universities and colleges, and they really were started by the youth. And so, and they've thrived in those markets. And so some people have in their mind college communities as where food co-ops are. And actually, food co-ops are in all different kinds of communities all over the nation. So even the ones that are already established that have been here since the 70s and 80s, you know, from major cities like New York City, you know, to tiny little rural communities in the UP, you know, Upper Peninsula, and everything in between, food co-ops serve many different kinds of communities. But specific to your question, in this wave of food co-op organizing, this last 10 years or so, it continues to be highly diverse. We serve startups in lots of little tiny towns, working with some rural communities in Connecticut, in Georgia, in Wisconsin, in California. I mean, just everywhere. And cool. And when we say rural, as you may know, and maybe your listeners know, but there's a lot of diversity even within what's considered rural, because we're usually going by the USDA standard, right? And that can be like Whitewater, Wisconsin, we're working with them. There's a terrific organizing group there. You know, and they have a population when the students are in town of about 20,000. It's quite a little town. And then we have other communities, Marmaton Market that just opened in Kansas that got open. And that community has a population, I think, under 1,000. So even within that, there's a lot of diversity. But then we're also working, you know, with some traditional college towns. Like we're working with Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, kind of a traditional college town type population. And then we're working with groups that are in major cities. There are several developing, there's two developing at the same time in Chicago, Illinois right now. But there's also ones forming in Durham, North Carolina, and Raleigh, North Carolina, working the group in each of those towns. So it's everything, you know, every different type of community. What's been fascinating is it's not one type of community. Everyone wants this. And for some pretty diverse reasons, actually, as well.
Yeah. Explain out some of the reasons that people would want a food co-op. I mean, I think about, I'm based in Denton, Texas. It's a college town. So hearing you saying that food co-ops can thrive in college towns really excites me. And it reminds me, we had a local grocery downtown. It was called The Cupboard. It was there for 50 years, a great story of incremental development. It started off in a little 500 square foot space, ended up moving eventually into a 6,000 square foot space downtown. Wonderful, just core place for our neighborhood. Mm. Sadly, last year it closed. And it's interesting because a lot of my neighbors, you know, we're not talking about starting a food co-op. Instead, our first response was to start a change.org campaign to try to get a bunch of signatures to incentivize a Trader Joe's to move in. Why do you think that is? Do you think some folk just aren't familiar with food co-ops, don't think that their particular city or town is viable enough for a food co-op? Why are we so quick to, you know, try to incentivize corporations to move in as opposed to starting a food co-op on our own?
It's a terrific question, and I think it's built of the culture we're in. I think in the 70s, the wave of food co-ops, we saw to that. I mean, everybody was starting a food co-op out of their garage, out of church basements, out of, you know, and I think there was more this sense that it was reachable for just anyone. And we were doing more, I mean, just as a community, more active organizing. We spent more time in community, in church community, going to school board meetings, whatever, whatever have you. And now it's interesting, a lot of communities that we work with, the food co-op was the second idea. The first idea was, let's lure a corporation here. And they find out quickly through that process that that is not how it works, that these organizations, these chains, are making very strategic decisions based on where they can extract the most capital, where they can get the most sales for the least investment. And so it's not based on how much you want it, it's based on how much they can make. And 9 times out of 10, I'd actually be willing to say 99 times out of 100 from the number of communities I've talked to, they don't get that chain to come. But I think it's where people start, because that, I mean, it is organizing. And to be honest, we're not disappointed when we hear that, like, oh, they didn't want a food co-op at first or had never heard of that. Because what happened was they started to organize as a community. They thought about who to contact, right? You know, how to get all those signatures. Who do we need to meet with? And what we see is the seed of that empowerment that is absolutely necessary and has to grow far stronger if we're going to open a food co-op. This is not a simple endeavor in this day and age. So, you know, I think it's a natural go-to in a time when we aren't used to seeing people solve problems this big on their own.
Yeah. Jacqueline, let's transition into how listeners can capitalize on that empowerment and that enthusiasm. I know I spoke about the Denton story. We got 2,000 signatures. So I imagine there's at least 2,000 residents in downtown who, whether it's the delicious frozen orange chicken at Trader Joe's or a local product down the road, want to see a grocery downtown. You know, I think it's easy to be enthusiastic. And it's an issue that I find myself stuck in. I can sometimes get overly enthusiastic. You know, I see that the cupboard closes and I'm like, you know what? Food co-op. It's going to work, no doubt. I love this idea. Let's make it happen. So the enthusiasm is easy. But as you guys are well aware at the Food Co-op Initiative, once we get into the weeds of it, you know, finding capital, doing a feasibility report, it can get much more challenging. And if not maybe with the best approach, it can be discouraging and maybe prevent a project from even taking off in the first place. Jacqueline, if someone has that enthusiasm, what's the right way to, you know, soberly and stoically approach this process? How do we get started?
It's a really good question, and I love how you phrased it, because the reality is we do get a lot of phone calls from people who are very enthusiastic about this solution, and we're clearly enthusiastic about this solution. I put immense hours into it. I love what I do. I love working with co-ops and working with groups, but the reality is we're not opening in the 70s. We're not opening in a vacuum. There's a whole system of food distribution that in our country that is very consolidated. And we have to figure out how to function and open professional grocery stores that people will shop in up against that. Because the reality is people are price conscious, but they're also, food is becoming one of the pleasures we all still can indulge in and afford every day. And we don't really these days tend to want to shop in a place where we've thrown up some random shelves and bulk bins and they're only open 3 days, you know, 3 hours a day. And it, you know, it's kind of, people want a very professional experience, and that's expensive. And so we are building professional businesses that have to be able to compete, not only against any competition in town. It sounds like you guys don't necessarily have a lot, but even the competition online or even the competition at the Walmart 20 miles outside of town. And if we want to stay open and actually enrich our communities. So it is a big undertaking. And when people say, how do you maintain the enthusiasm or how do I start? I think the first thing is actually kind of digest the reality and as a community and decide if you're up for it. Because it is, on average, it takes anywhere from 3 to 7 years of organizing to open a food co-op. The average these days is 5 years.
Wow.
That's average. And the impacts can be immense. The thing is, you're not growing something that will impact your community for a few years. If you do this right, it will actually anchor your downtown, your local food movement, create jobs for decades to come. And the impacts can't be quantified even, the way it changes a community and brings a community together. But we have to really do the work right or it won't survive in the current just capitalist environment. So I say to people, actually, the best early organizing I've seen is when people have gotten together a big community meeting of people who are interested in this idea, got them excited, but then laid down the reality. Are we as a community up for? Can we put together, you know, a steering committee, and can we put in 3 to 5 years of work to get this done? Is it worth it? What does that look like? And people think that'll be demoralizing, but I've actually seen, I've been honored to be at some of these community meetings that have happened in my region. And I'm amazed that when we lay down the truth of what it's going to take, how that isn't demoralizing. People really find the gumption and get excited because it seems real and realistic, and they do believe their community can do that thing. Where if we go in with blind enthusiasm and not the reality of what it's going to take to transform our community, then we see it peter out.
It reminds me of our last episode of It's Little Things. We had a gentleman from Elkin, North Carolina on the podcast, and it was all about how they're reinventing the rural economy. They started an organization called Explore Elkin, where, you know, instead of waiting for grants or a loan from the state or the federal government, Jeff, like you said, got up on stage, gathered this group of community members and said, are you willing to buy in to create the Elkin that you envision?
Nice.
And then he said, all I'm asking for is $100. I think they were able to raise $50,000. They renovated a theater that now works as a co-working space, a movie theater, a music venue. And like you said, it starts with just bringing the community together and pitching that shared vision. Jacqueline, if someone has the enthusiasm, they have the vision, how can FCI help with gathering people and pitching that vision? Have you noticed that the past gatherings that you've attended, it comes naturally for folk? Can the FCI provide some additional literature to help this advocate really pitch that vision to their peers?
That's an excellent question. We absolutely can. First off, we have a video, which we often encourage people to show at that first meeting to kind of give a feel for what a food co-op is and what it can do for your community. But more importantly, hopefully you've been, if you're before that meeting, this advocate has read our free book on how to do this and has watched some of our free videos and has gotten in contact with us, and we can process this through, because first we really need to identify, why does your community want this? What is that driving reason that they're organizing for a food co-op, which can be pretty diverse? And we touched on this earlier. It can really be everything from, you know, our community doesn't have any grocery store. We were just left, you know, and no chains will come here anymore, to we really want to boost up the local food economy, to it's all about creating jobs. Employers keep leaving this community, and the most exciting part of this for us is job creation that won't leave. There's lots of different angles. So we need to figure out why is your community excited? And then we can provide you with some information and data on communities similar to yours that do have food co-ops or have developed food co-ops, and what kind of impacts it has created. And so I think that's the leverage point, is getting to know how your community and why you want a food co-op, and then being able to look at what it's done for similar communities and help you put together that pitch, that conversation.
I love that, Jacqueline. And I imagine it allows the advocate to be able to tailor their message per their audience, you know, because I might share different benefits to an elected official. You know, I might focus on job creation. I might focus on the increased tax base, as opposed to
Absolutely.
Talking to my neighbor who's in a food desert, whose concern might primarily be, how do I just get the day's needs? And I won't ask for the titles of the resources now, but listeners, I'll make sure to get links to the resources that Jacqueline mentioned and put them in the show notes. So Jacqueline, I want to talk about, you know, the storefront itself. You know, we've gathered our peers, they've bought into the vision, we've decided why we're pursuing this in the first place. You know, going from idea to storefront can be risky, you know, especially if the property owner requires you to sign a multi-year lease. Do you know of any success stories of companies starting with just a low cost, low risk strategy? Like, do you know of any food crops that have started in, you know, the back of a like punk record store, or started in, like you said before, a garage or a coffee shop? Any tips for people who love this idea, understand the value of a co-op, but maybe aren't ready to go from idea to multi-year lease?
It's a really interesting question, and one we get very commonly. So first, I'm going to put the caveat out there that what we have seen in the current grocery environment, because you are entering a grocery business environment, that is, if you want eventually to have a storefront grocery store that is open, you know, 7 days a week and really filling that function in your community, starting small can actually prevent you to getting where you need to be. And I can actually share more failures than successes in that. But since you asked for some successes, so I would say the caveat is think big, but in some communities, in some, and I would say there's only if someone was looking from the green light for me to say, maybe look at some of these smaller ideas, I'm probably willing to do that maybe in 5% of cases, because usually what they need is a real grocery store. But and it takes the time and investment. But and starting small, the problem with starting small is we have had some groups start literally in, like, you know, the front half of a meat of a little local butcher shop, or have, you know, projects like of that nature, or start with a local foods buying club. And what happens is it takes all the time and organizing and volunteers and all the energy you can come up with to run that. And then the hard work of organizing the grocery store doesn't happen. And so we often see those projects close. But our success story, and I think it's a very interesting model right now, especially in rural communities, is from Sitka, Alaska, which I thought was cold. Turns out it's beautiful. They are on the Pacific coast.
Good for grocery shopping.
You know, but they're isolated. They're extremely isolated. There's no way to get there except for by plane. And so their groceries come in by barge, or, you know, and it's quite something. And so they have very high grocery prices, but they only have one grocery store in town. And in their case, it didn't carry any local or organic. And what they wanted was access to more healthy, non-processed food. And so they started as a buying club, which we usually don't recommend. And they were purchasing through a natural foods distributor, as well as getting everything they could from local farms within a certain radius. And they had a physical location. Instead of being like, this is the parking lot that we all meet up in and split up our stuff and go home, they did get someone to give them a free location, a building where they could just keep their stuff indefinitely. So they were there all day on delivery days. They'd get together, break down everything. You know, everyone got their orders, went home. But it quickly turned into, well, you know, then they sometimes people buy a pack of something and eight people want it and there's four left over. And they started having the shelves, filling shelves with what was left over and a few other popular items and staying open 1 or 2 days a week. Well, usually these buying clubs maybe do $50,000 a year if you're lucky in sales. Sitka started, you know, just a little buying club. Then it became kind of a buying club, kind of sort of slash store. And now as a buying club slash store, they're doing well over $500,000 a year in sales. And they've made almost no fiscal investment whatsoever in it. They had nothing to lose in it. It took a lot of volunteer hours. And now they are looking at actually building that permanent grocery store. But it's taken them a lot longer than they hoped, because they have been putting a lot of energy into this. But the question sometimes also is, what is it your community needs? I've often thought, we call this the buying club on steroids. And it's funny, when Sitka did it, I was already imagining, like, you know, this might work in some rural communities, because it's a gathering space. You maybe deliveries are twice a week. People get together. They have people who come in and play music. You know, they have people who come and sell a little bit of hot food, but you also pick up your groceries. Cool. And it's really become, you know, access. And it's also become a community gathering space. There's nothing wrong. If that's what your community wants, there's nothing wrong with that. We encourage people to start where they want to end up. So if what you want is a buying club, or a buying club on steroids that has a little bit of a shop and a gathering aspect, then start there. And that can do phenomenal things for your community. But if what you want is a full service grocery store, start there, because that's going to take all your energy and resources as a community to do. And doing something other than where you want to end up, it can stop you from getting to where you actually intend to get.
We've shared that vision And it's like, we need community members to give, you know, X amount, however much they want to give, because it's what all of us collectively want for town. So it'd be much more easier, I imagine, for a resident to give 500, 1,000, 2,000, whenever they're totally committed to the end product, as opposed to just health food in general. Jacqueline, let's talk about how advocates for food co-ops can work with elected officials. We chatted a little bit before how they can use the language of, you know, expanding the tax base, more job creation. In your experience, how important is that relationship between the advocate and the elected official to really making a local food co-op happen?
It is hugely important, but it takes time. One thing we see in the beginning is that city officials don't come on board quickly with these projects 9 times out of 10. And the reason is they don't understand what it is, right? I mean, they don't know what a food co-op is. And again, they're used to whatever problem you're trying to solve with a food co-op, they're used to solving it by luring in a corporation. So it takes them time to come around to this idea. So we always say it's so important. This relationship can be make or break, especially in a time when, honestly, they're giving lots of subsidies to these corporations that come in, and food co-ops need them too. We need them to pour that money into a locally owned business. And getting the odd thing that many of you, I'm sure many of your guests have brought up or you've run into yourself, is cities are overjoyed to pour money into these corporate chains coming in from the outside, but they have a harder time being convinced to pour them into locally owned businesses. And so we're going to have to just get them comfortable with the cooperative model in general. One of the co-op startups in our state, in my state, in Illinois, invited me when they were pretty early in their development process to come present to their city's develop, you know, to their development committee, and the mayor was also stopped in. And I started with just, what is a food co-op? Showing them pictures and images of co-ops from similar communities that made them go, oh, aha, that's actually really attractive and professional. That doesn't look like the buying club in someone's garage, which some of them think it is. And then I dove into the things you pointed out. I mean, you do have to speak their language. It's such an excellent point you made, Jacob. And so, and it's real. Their concerns are your concerns. Your owners want to create good jobs in the community. So do they. Also, though, we want those sales happening in our city, right? Like a lot of the communities I work with, some have a lot of grocery stores actually in their community, but many don't, and they need the economic stimulus. And if those grocery dollars are being spent in your community, not in the Walmart 20 miles away, not the online Amazon drop, but is actually that money goes right back into your economy, that stimulates your economy, that's compelling these days. It is tough to get dollars to stay in the community, and city leaders know it. And if you can prove there's already a successful movement of food co-ops that bring millions of dollars of revenue into their communities every year, and actually even bring people from outside the community to spend their dollars in that community, now you're talking their language. And the data is out there to prove that that is just what food co-ops do.
Oh, that's remarkable, Jacqueline. And what we write a lot about strong towns, a lot of these food co-ops, you know, they usually are in a historic downtowns. There's a lot less public infrastructure that has to be maintained. And the result is when we compare the little, you know, food co-op storefront compared to the Walmart, where the city's had to pave miles on miles of asphalt, had to build parking, these food co-ops usually end up having more tax revenue per acre compared to the Walmart.
There's a study we need to do. I love that idea, Jacob. It's a good point.
And then add that to everything you mentioned, how it's, you know, we're keeping our dollars in the community. And what resonates most with me, Jacqueline, is that these food co-ops, they're serving our neighbors. They're serving community members. They're not serving investors who are solely focused on profit, maybe. You know, would go as far as cutting wages or jobs to ensure they get the best return on investment. These storefronts are so much more than healthy food. I mean, it's giving people a sense of place. It's giving neighbors a sense of ownership. And Jacqueline, I appreciate you sharing your expertise. And I know I'm personally motivated to hopefully get something going on in
Wonderful.
Denton.
Well, we can't wait to help you and anyone else listening learn about how to get their food co-op started.
I love it. Jacqueline, final thing, you've shared a lot about how FCI can help throughout this process. Is there anything that we didn't cover, any essential resources that would be useful for a listener who's interested in starting their own co-op?
If you're interested in starting a food co-op, please head on over to our website, fci.coop.coop, and download our book on how to start a food co-op. It's free, and it'll really give you an overview of what it takes and what's involved, as well as many success stories are peppered throughout it and the types of impacts they've had. So it will just give you an excellent overview, and it may diminish your appetite when you hear what you're up against, but it's a really good realistic picture both of what you can accomplish through a food co-op and what it's going to take.
Love it. Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much again. If anyone wants to connect with FCI, learn more about the work you guys are doing, where can people find you online?
They can find us at our website, www.fci.coop. And if you want to reach out to me personally or the organization, it's info@fci.coop. And we'd love to talk.
Wonderful. Jacqueline, thank you so much. We'll chat very soon.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. If you're enjoying the content, please subscribe to It's the Little Things on iTunes, and we will chat next week. See ya.